Welcome to Worlds Apart. Jokingly dismissed or shamefully suppressed, porn is nonetheless a very complex and a very convex phenomenon, revealing something hidden both about its consumers and societies at large. Like any collective preoccupation, it gratifies and punishes, exalts and exhausts, exposes and misrepresents. With porn sites still drawing the chunk of internet traffic, what makes porn such a symbol of the zeitgeist? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Giorgio Tricarico, a clinical psychologist from Helsinki, Finland, and author of Lost Goddesses, A Kaleidoscope on Porn. Giorgio, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time and congratulations on this amazing book.
Thank you very much, Sam. Thank you.
Now, as I said, you're joining us from Finland, and here in Russia, it is a subject of many lurid and politically incorrect jokes about the hot Finnish man. And coupled with the data you cite in your book that 9 out of 10 Finnish men are consumers of porn, I wonder if there's something in the Helsinki era that not only sparked your interest, but also gave you the sort of the scientific courage to explore a subject like this.
No, I don't think it's linked with my living in Finland. I am from Milano, Italy, and I moved here to Helsinki only 13 years ago. Actually, the interest in such a topic and in writing something started long ago. And first I started reading many books about porn that I could find. And then I came to the conclusion that at least in the Jungian field, there was nothing written about it. And in general, in the psychoanalytical environment, porn is always addressed in its pathological sides. And I thought it was missing a kind of exploration of porn as a phenomenon in itself and what it could tell about the current zeitgeist, like you said. So this started long before my coming to Finland. And by the way, yes, in the book I mentioned this data about porn consumers. I quoted this very interesting research done in Finland because it was a very long research. It started in 1970. And they were inquiring many dimensions of sexuality up to the present time. But I know that other researches in different countries in the West, they say basically the same results. So it's not only Finland that is hotter, but actually everywhere in Western countries, there is this kind of result, like 9 men on 10, and maybe nowadays 7 women over 10 are a usual porn consumer. So I don't think Finland is particularly hot by this perspective.
Well, it's just a subject of many jokes about the temperament of the Finnish and Nordic people here in Russia. In your book, you show very elegantly how porn went from an obscure, somewhat elitist fascination to a mass phenomenon in, I think, somewhat 50 years, first starting with the legalization in Denmark and then in the United States in the 1970s. And I was surprised to learn that the collapse of the Soviet Union, the country where I was born, also made a major contribution to the industry. In what way?
Porn developed for many, let's say for 100 years, probably in a very niche style. It was just accessible by few people in the elite in the Western countries. Like you mentioned, it's only by the end of the 60s and the beginning of the 70s that porn production and distribution was allowed by laws in some countries, starting with Denmark and the US, then France, Italy, and many other countries. So my book is about mass porn, so it's dedicated mostly to the period of the last 50 years, and especially is dedicated to porn intended for men, so heterosexual men. This is important to say, because the phenomenon is very wide nowadays, so I tried to focus on what is still the mainstream porn nowadays. And during the 70s and the 80s, porn was a kind of side industry to film industry. And actually there were unions in many countries and actors of porn movies, they were trying to structure their work as any other work. But when Soviet Union collapsed, there was a massive let's say, amount of women, most of all, girls and women, basically willing to do anything in order to earn some money, which poured into the Western world, so to say. And this changed completely the landscape of porn industry, because it went towards a more amateur phenomenon. Anybody with a camera could film and produce something, and then the internet was developing also during the 90s. So basically these two factors together created a new landscape where all the unions also, let's say, the rules of the previous porn industry were swept away by this new phenomenon. So yes, the coming from especially Ukraine, Belarus, Poland, and Russia, of actresses, so to say, changed the landscape in the 90s.
And, correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I heard you say in other interviews, it's not just about the nature of work and how actresses are paid and how they're protected, but also about the style, or sort of the aim of the product itself. Because I heard you say before that back in the 70s and the 80s, it was much more about the mutual pleasure, but then it shifted towards far more violent and dominating kind of genre. Do you attribute that to a cultural influx of women from the former Soviet Union, or is it just the nature of time itself, or the nature of male sexuality that has changed over time?
Well, this is a very interesting question. Well, I would say that the availability of women willing to do anything went well together with the increasing going towards the extreme that was already present in the 70s and 80s, but it was more somehow regulated. And especially in the 70s, since the previous decade, the 60s, was a period in the West of big changes, social changes. There was feminist movements and equality movements. So in that moment, the fact that porn was representing female sexuality as a joyful and disconnected from procreation, as a pleasure for women, it was a very big new thing, element in that moment. So it was already extreme during the 70s and 80s. I mean, we can find it extreme back then too. But definitely the general atmosphere was much different from the current porn, which is very much about using a woman for the male pleasure. I wouldn't dare to say that there was a cultural contribution from the side of the women. I think patriarchy was already there. And the idea that actually we could exploit all these women willing to do anything just was a market advantage, so to say.
Now, one of the central ideas in your book is that technological inventions, and you demonstrate how porn is a technological invention, are not natural tools. They don't just satisfy our needs, but they form and shape them, sometimes with pretty malicious and insidious motives. I wonder, how do you yourself try to maintain, if not an autonomy, then some degree of non-dependency on those technological tools, porn and anything else?
Yeah, also this is a very wide and interesting question. In a way, human beings have always been technological from the very first time when somebody created a container to bring the water from the river to the cavern. Probably already that was a technological invention, something out of the nature. But definitely the last 150 years saw a dramatic change in our landscape, to the point that technology, according to the philosopher Günther Anders, that I quote a lot in the book, became the subject of history. And actually, in his opinion, we as human beings are only co-historical to technology. So definitely we live in a technological world, and porn is just one of the many objects, technological objects that surround us. And definitely is not only a tool in our hands, and it depends on how we use it, if it's good or bad. This is a kind of a naive position, according to Anders. He claims that actually we should be worried about how technology uses us, which is a reverse perspective, where technology actually can change deeply our, even our emotions and the way we are in the world. It's a fact, although that technology is the current world. So I don't think that we can imagine a world without it. It's a very, very difficult process to balance our relationship with technology within a technological world. I think that the starting point is to question seriously our technological landscape. And I mean, I try to do it even in this book on porn, although the topic is much wider than porn.
Now, you mentioned Günther Anders, the German industrial philosopher, who in many ways was ahead of his time, foretelling the dangers of being enslaved by technology, so much so that his second book of essays was titled The Obsolescence of Man. I know that you don't like judging or moralizing in any way, but do you think by and large, 40 years after the publication of this book, we have come to his dystopian forecast being proven that people, not all of them, but by and large, are losing touch, not only with the free spirit in them, but also the bodies, because when you look at porn, it's both dispirited and disembodied in the same time. It's a strange union of opposites, a union without a union.
Yes, you're right. I personally think that the word described by Günther Anders is kind of now present. I really wonder how he would have considered the current internet world, for example, in virtuality and so on, because many of his reflections were based on radio and TV. It's pretty amazing. He was foreseeing something that is really much more talking about the current world, although he died, I think, in the 80s, so before the internet. I do believe that his dystopian world is present in this moment. I know that there are many other thinkers that are much more positive about technology, and they believe that it's just, the normal development of human consciousness going towards that. I am closer to Günther Anders' worries, so to say. And but of course, there is possibility to discuss about it. But I am worried as he was.
Well, interestingly, that despite him being so much ahead of his time, he is not widely published in English. You know, we usually think of the Western world as the driver of both the third and the fourth industrial revolution, and yet there are very few translations of his work that are mostly on of an amateur nature. I wonder if that is just an unfortunate happenstance to you, or if you think it's a sort of a form of deliberate intellectual ostracizing.
As an analyst, it's hard not to think that there is a meaning in this repression of Günther Anders' work in English literature. But now a book has been finally published in English. I found out this year there is a big work, I think it's published in America, about Günther Anders' works in general. It's some 500 pages book. So they have now finally translated something and spoken of him. It's interesting because his first volume was published in the end of the Second World War, 1948, I think, and the second one in the 80s or 1980. In Italian, I could find a translation, and it was already existing since the 60s. But in the English literature world, so to say, it's only in last year, maybe, it was published. So I see it as a little bit of a repression because it was a very critical voice, especially for the American society.
And he was also a contemporary of Jung, and I think Jungian ideas are also seeing a bit of a revival. So maybe it's a synchronistic event in a way that their works are coming back to prominence. Anyway, Giorgio, we have to take a very short break right now. We'll be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. to Worlds Apart with Giorgio Tricarico, a clinical psychologist from Finland and author of Lost Goddesses, A Kaleidoscope on Porn. Giorgio, before the break, we touched upon this very central idea in your book, as well as in the work of Günther Anders, that technological inventions are not neutral tools. They not only satisfy our needs, but also shape and foster them, and sometimes they even create our needs. And you provide a very interesting example of Coca-Cola as something that for many people essentially managed to hijack their basic need for thirst, and by claiming to satisfy it, it actually increases it. And I think that's a very sort of common thing within the big food industry, as well as within the big pharma industry, because there are a lot of very obnoxious synergies there. If you look at the most prevalent diseases, metabolic diseases right now, be it diabetes, dementia, Alzheimer's, obesity, many of them could be traced to people being hooked on certain foods or on certain habits. And I think porn is perhaps recreating the same dynamic in certain populations. It could be very helpful to some or very imaginative to some, but in many people, it also creates addiction. And I understand it's a very complex question. I understand you don't like passing judgments, but where do you think we should start in terms of both assigning responsibility? Because, you know, health budgets are something that we are all concerned about. It's a public good. And also helping people develop a helpful and sort of mutually respectful relationship with technology and new inventions and the industries that produce them.
Yes. Your questions are always very interesting and super big. They would require a lot of time to reflect upon the questions. Well, I would say that taking the example of porn, the aim of my book was to show different sides of it, which is something that I didn't find in many books. I called the book A Kaleidoscope on Porn, with the idea that every chapter should have been a color, and all the colors together, they were forming this kaleidoscope so that the reader can turn the book, so to say, and see maybe some configurations or others. I start from this in order to reply to your question, meaning that when a phenomenon is very complex, like porn is, having the possibility to see many colors and embrace this complexity is the first step that we have to do before doing what you were asking. The same about technology. Technology is a very complex topic. It requires a lot of reflections and, so to say, deepening of many aspects before we can decide something about what can we do in order not to be just addicted. So, you know, what I thought it was missing in many books on porn was this complexity. They were only focusing on some aspect, for example, addiction or pathological or perversion. But porn is a very complex object and actually is just a good symbol of many other phenomena of our current world. Mm-hmm. So what you asked requires, first of all, to know much better and to a much deeper level a topic, and then we can try to understand what can we do about it.
Well, we can invite our viewers to get your book and reflect on it. But I can tell you from a personal perspective that one of the very simple, but for some reason, very insightful ideas for me was that we not just live in our bodies, but we are the bodies, the desiring bodies. And your book demonstrates it in a very interesting way. And there is, I think, a huge difference between perceiving yourself as living in the body and actually imagining yourself that same body. Can you speak about that a little bit?
Yes, this is an important point because porn, for example, since it's an experience, a technological object through a screen, basically we are speaking nowadays of videos or pictures, it's very interesting how technology invites a kind of split with the body, because we look at some sex and sex performance. And the only senses that we are using in that moment are basically sight and earrings, because there is audio in the video. But actually, sex as a real experience, as an embodied experience, would be much more involving the other senses, like taste, smell, and touch, most of all. It's very interesting how, like you said before, there is a kind of a combination of opposites. Like, porn is a sexual thing, but actually it doesn't have anything to do with the sexual embodied experience, because we're just sitting in front of a screen. There's nothing physical there.
For some people, there are some physical things. I mean, mildly physical. People not just watch, they, I think, use their imagination and sometimes their hands to...
Oh, of course, yes. I mean, there is not an embodied experience with other people. We can have touch ourselves, but it's not the same thing as a real sexual intercourse.
Well, can I actually ask you about that? Because I think this is a fascinating question, and sexuality is one of the sort of five top basic instincts that Carl Jung identified. And I think more than others, it requires the presence of the other, you know?
Yes.
And you Jungians like to talk about the benefits of living imagination. But I wonder if there is perhaps a downside to that too. As a clinical psychologist, what are some of the dangers of living out too much of your sexuality in this imaginary realm?
Yes. Oh, this is also a very important topic too. I believe that as Jungians, but all the psychoanalytical work, let's say, it's very much leaning on the verbal side. And we tend to not to give too much attention to the body. But there are movements, so to say, in the psychoanalytical world that are trying to include the body level much more. And there are very interesting crossovers between, for example, Jungian theory and authentic movement or dance therapy and other things that involve more the body. So, yeah, there is always this risk to disconnect from the physical and embodied experience. There is the need to keep polarities together, like imagination, but also the body level. So porn as a technological object invites to split from the body experience in a way. And this is one example. I mean, this is happening a lot with technology, that we can disconnect from the body, we can disconnect from the emotions, we can disconnect even from ethics, because, we just watch a video. What's our responsibility in what's going on in that video? Maybe it's a violent video or something despicable that we would never do in reality, but still we are enjoying something which is violent. So there's a lot of questions that are posed by these splittings. And definitely, you try to reconnect body and mind much more, also in the Jungian theory.
And I think there's a huge need for that in the world, because if you look at the data, despite this very wide availability of porn, people around the developed world are having less sex. They're having it later in their lives. It's also less procreative, not only because of the birth control, but also because of the precipitously falling sperm counts in many of the Western men. If we step outside the porn for a while, what do you think is happening with human sexuality in general within this larger view of technology and the fourth industrial revolution that we are about to enter?
Yeah, well, on one hand, there are many signs of a crisis, like you were mentioning. On the other, I'm reading so many interesting books that are addressing sexuality in new ways and very interesting ways. I have in mind a book called Magnificent Sex, which is a research by two Canadian PhD authors, female authors. But I'm reading a lot of books about sexuality and couple relationship and polyamory and many new, let's say, developments also of relating and having sex. So like you said in the beginning, there are always some opposite phenomena happening at the same time. There is a crisis of the previous way, maybe, of sexuality. The patriarchal crisis is investing also the way sexuality has always been intended. And hopefully this new elements that are starting circulating will change the landscape in the future. So I hope that we will have all better sex and better relationship with ourselves and the others.
Well, and perhaps a better relationship with reality, which I think is the goal of any psychological school, but especially in depth psychology, it's seen as one of the aims to allow reality to reveal its real godlike magic to mere mortals. Since you have the word goddesses in the title, what do they have to do with such a base activity as porn?
Yeah, I know we have a very short time still left, so I tried to make a hint about it. Maybe the listener would be curious to see it in the book in a more extensive way. I had the idea, let's say the hypothesis, that a factor of fascination for porn should be found also outside the usual pathological explanations. Porn is definitely fascinating for the majority of men and women around the world. We can include even other genders. And I believe that reducing everything to pathology is a bit too narrowing. So my hypothesis is that actually in porn, it's possible to find some hint to what in other eras was connected to the sacred. And this is a very big topic. In other eras, the sacred was placed in the undifferentiated, I was calling like this, like a place beyond good and bad, a place of the gods, not the place of the human beings. So in a very strange way, porn somehow evokes something that has to do with the undifferentiated. And I explain it with details in the book, but it's really a long topic now. And for this reason, I sense that in porn, there is some hint to the sacred that actually is fascinating, because we live in a desacralized world, basically. Since Nietzsche's statement that God is dead, we can say that the sacred has disappeared and has faded.
Well, but you know, any Jungian would reply to you that Vacatus ad canon, vacatus deus erit. So whether he is called or not, the gods are still present. It's a matter of seeing and perceiving them and having a right relationship with them. Georgia, I have to leave it there. I wish I could have more time to discuss this fascinating book, and I invite our readers to get it. You have an advantage over Russians. I think it's still available around the world on Amazon. So take a chance on that.
Thank you very much, Oksana, for this this possibility to talk.
Thank you, and thank you for watching. Hope to see you again next week on Worlds Apart.